from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
You need to operate a system in such a way that people can have confidence in the integrity of the election, and the way that we have made some of these changes is not healthy for the future of the country, and people of all parties, whether they're on the winning side or losing side, should care deeply about this going forward.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Molly Hemingway, our first guest on today's program. Molly is a senior journalism fellow at Hillsdale College, also a senior editor at The Federalist, a Fox News contributor, and author of the brand new book, Rigged: How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections. We talk at length with Molly about the new book and what she found in the course of reporting it. Molly, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here with you.
It's always nice to have an opportunity to talk, and especially when you're going to have a best-selling book on your hands. This is a reported book. This is a deeply reported book on the election and what led up to it. And the question you try to answer is, what really happened? Did you enter this with any assumptions of your own as to what you thought was going on?
Yes. When I was covering the 2020 campaign, I was appalled at the way that the media were rigging the game by how they were covering different campaigns, how they covered news stories. It was really something that had been a growing problem throughout the Trump presidency, where they were engaged in just spreading absolutely ridiculous stories that have a huge effect on the population, such as the Russia collusion hoax, which was their conspiracy theory that the 2016 election was stolen by Donald Trump colluding with Russia. And that dominated the news for a long period of time. You get to the campaign, and it seemed like the media were mostly running the Biden campaign, enabling him to stay at home while mm-hmm. they did the work of dirtying up his opponent and elevating him. And so I really wanted to focus on the media and also big tech, which had developed into a much more powerful player, censoring viewpoints that they didn't like, banning people that they didn't like from their platforms, controlling algorithms so that when you put in search terms, it directed you to have a particular response that was politically weighted.
Let's walk through those three big things and then get a little deeper. Media, big tech, Democrats. You mentioned already the media a bit, and we've talked often about the influence and the bias inside a lot of the media outlets around the country. What, in your mind, is the influence that remains in the legacy media outlets, and how much power do they retain leading into 2020 and even now?
So it's kind of weird, right? A lot of Americans have lost any faith in these institutions. The media have never had such low credibility ratings as they do now. But on the other hand, they still control the conversation. And so you look at some of the stories that they ran with that had no basis. In fact, the Ayn Marne military cemetery story that The Atlantic ran with late in the campaign, which was an unsubstantiated claim based on an unknown number of anonymous sources that said that President Trump had said horrible things about dead U.S. veterans. This was refuted by like 20-some people on the record and contemporary accounts, and yet it still dominated the news coverage for days. And it dominated the news coverage at a time when there was a really good piece of news for the Trump campaign, which is the success of yet another Mideast peace agreement that had mm-hmm. been brokered by the Trump administration. And so it really is important, even if a lot of people don't believe it, it's still, they can have a lot of control and influence.
One story in particular, late in the campaign, the story about Hunter Biden and his laptop, which was suppressed by the media, which ended up we'll talk about big tech in a second, but big tech getting involved and literally banning the New York Post from the site for posting about this story. And of course, now we know that it was true. I mean, everything was true. And there are these actions on behalf of Joe Biden, on behalf of Democrats by the media. They're not umpires. They're arbitrators. They're siding with one side all the time.
I would argue that many people in the corrupt propaganda environment that we call our media are the most powerful political players that we have, and their ability to squash a very legitimate news story was horrifying, I think, for a lot of Americans. And again, the context, we had gone through years of a legitimate international business being scrutinized so completely. Like, whatever you know about Donald Trump, you know his family is engaged in a global real estate business.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was scrutinized at such a high level that I think even his friends and allies are shocked they didn't find bad things happening there. And yet the Biden family business doesn't seem to have that same legitimacy. Near as we can tell, and you give money to members of the Biden family because of their proximity to Joe Biden, the elected official. Seems like this is a prime opportunity for journalists to dig in and say, why are these foreign governments giving so much money to these people? What are they getting out of it? And yet the media never wanted to look into it. And then when news came out that there was potential corruption involved in this business, they killed it.
Molly Hemingway with us. Her new book, Rigged, How the Media, Big Tech, and Democrats Seized Our Elections. Let's talk about big tech, but also bring in the last part of that triumvirate, the Democratic Party. How are big tech and Democrats working with regard to our elections? Who is Mark Elias?
So Mark Elias is a top Democrat attorney who has been general counsel on major presidential campaigns and ran the Democrats' operation by which they tried to change election laws in a way that would be more favorable to their party's interests. So that could mean watering down signature verification, expanding mail-in balloting, which is a major strategy of the Democratic Party. Democrats are far more likely to trust the people involved with handling ballots than Republicans, probably for good reason. And so he orchestrated the campaign to change all the election laws and procedures. Interestingly enough, he also designed or was a major player in the Russia collusion hoax. He was the one that was the pass through between the Clinton campaign and all the groups that he funded to run that hoax. And so he's a powerful player, and he also he and other Democrats were involved in this brilliant strategy to win the 2020 election, which was to take big tech money, namely Mark Zuckerberg's hundreds of millions of dollars, and to funnel it through two left-wing organizations that were ostensibly helping out with COVID problems, you know, COVID problems in election administration. So they would give these massive grants to particularly Democratic counties like or cities like Philadelphia. Like Philadelphia got $10 million to help with their election administration. And then they were told that they could only spend the money on a list of approved groups, all of which were staffed by left-wing radical activists. And they would do everything from design the ballot to harvest the ballot to training people on how to do signature match. They basically embedded into what many people think is a neutral system, the election administration, and they did it using left-wing activists. It was a brilliant strategy because nobody had made it illegal at that time, mm-hmm. because nobody ever imagined that a left-wing oligarch like Mark Zuckerberg could control the outcome of an election.
Let's talk about more of the over-the-table doings leading up to the 2020 election. Going back a ways, in the mid-2000s, we had the Carter-Baker Commission on Elections, which warned us 17 years ago about absentee ballots, about mail-in ballots, about drop boxes, about ballot harvesting, and about the possibilities for a lack of election integrity in those methods. How did we end up adopting essentially all of them in the run-up to 2020?
It's so fascinating. Prior to the 2020 election and campaign, there was basically broad agreement both in this country and abroad that mail-in balloting was the least secure form of balloting. It doesn't mean that you're going to necessarily have a problem, but it's the most ripe for shenanigans.
Mm-hmm.
France banned mail-in balloting in the 70s because of how ripe for fraud it was. This Baker Carter Commission talked openly about how it gave the most opportunities for fraud. The New York Times used to talk about the growing ability to commit fraud through mail-in balloting. The thing is, it's very difficult to conclusively find fraud through mail-in balloting, which is why so many election integrity experts talk about the importance of doing in-person voting. It's just harder to do bad things when you're in person.
Molly will pause right there. Back in just a moment, more with Molly Hemingway, author of the brand new book, Rigged, How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We are talking with Molly Hemingway, author of the brand new book, Rigged, How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections. Molly, in the last segment, we were talking about mail-in voting. There is a talking point on the left about the popular vote for president, which of course doesn't exist, because if it mattered, candidates would campaign far differently. When it comes to the way that people voted in 2020, changing things in the months leading up to the election, allowing more mail-in voting, do we have a similar circumstance there, whereas if candidates knew well in advance that we were going to change the way that we were going to vote, they would have campaigned in different ways?
Well, I would maybe just say there are some states that do widespread mail-in balloting that do a good job with it, and that it's something that each state is going to have different issues that come into play, and it shouldn't be something that's rushed into. I'm actually not, I'm not thinking that's the best direction for everybody to go in there, because it's so important that people, there's so many issues that come into play. Voting lists, having integrity with voting lists, making sure that the people who are voting are the people who say that they're voting, making sure that their vote is not under duress. All of these things are made more difficult with widespread mail-in balloting. And, even like you take a state like Wisconsin, which allowed people to register for a mail-in ballot without showing an ID if they claimed that they were indefinitely confined. And, there were tens of thousands of people who were able to do that. I mean, there were maybe like 250,000 who signed up for it who had previously shown an ID. But you combine that with other issues that Wisconsin has, like they were supposed to remove something like 250,000 votes because of problems with their, whether people have moved and whatnot. A court ordered them to remove those names. They didn't. You combine those two problems together, you obviously have a recipe for shenanigans, that you have names on the list that should have been removed and an ability to vote without showing an ID. And those are just two of like 40 problems that can come with some of our changes to election law.
Talking with Molly Hemingway. Her new book is Rigged, How the Media, Big Tech, and Democrats Seized Our Elections. You can find her on Twitter, too, at MZ Hemingway. This is a deeply reported book, Rigged is. You talk to dozens and dozens and dozens of people. Take us inside, if you would, the White House on election night. What's happening with the president and his advisor?
Yeah, it was really interesting to talk to people who were there that night, and that was a really important day. They had put so much effort into preparing for Election Day, including having teams of attorneys both at the White House, or actually at the old executive office building, who were receiving input on anything that might have been going wrong. They had teams of attorneys built out in 17 different states that where they thought there might be a problem. And what's really weird is Election Day went very smoothly. There were no problems. Everything. They report that they got there early. They had the normal morning problems, like a polling place doesn't open up, or, some machine problems. And then everything just gets quiet. Their numbers are off the charts, even though it was hard to measure because of how much mail-in balloting was going on. They're not just hitting their targets. They are massively exceeding their targets. So they are flying high. And they're thinking about things like how to tell how the night is going to go based on how things are going in certain states. When Florida comes in and comes in hard for Donald Trump, they're just feeling like this is really great. They think that is a good sign for Georgia, which is right across the border. When Ohio comes in exactly how it had come in 2016, and they were told that that was a state that was, to be concerned about, they think things are going to go very similarly in neighboring Pennsylvania. So all the indications are going very well. And yet they can't get the media to call Florida. And it's weird because it actually is one of these places with widespread mail-in balloting, but they've streamlined their system after many horrific problems in recent decades. And so you have every elected official in Florida saying, what is going on? Why won't they call this? Why won't they call this? Finally, one of the outlets calls Florida for Trump, which everybody knew it had gone for Trump. And then a few minutes later, they call Arizona for Trump. And that was someone described it as having like the brakes on a car being pulled and being whipped around in another direction. It was such a shock to them. But they also start realizing at that point that while they had had a very successful election day, Democrats had had a very successful election month, 2 months really, prior to election day, that had just gone really well for them. They'd controlled the system from the outset, from the inside, and it mostly took Republicans by surprise.
Molly Hemingway, the book Rigged, How the Media, Big Tech, and Democrats Seized Our Elections. Reading through this, I was reminded of the title of Andy McCarthy's recent book, which is Ball of Collusion. When you look at the media and big tech and Democrats, is it collusion? Are they working together? Do they simply have the same end, and these things are sort of in confluence? How would you describe it?
I don't know how centrally organized it is, although after I had already started writing this book, this amazing article came out in Time magazine with people wanting to take credit for winning the election. And it all talked about how there was a quote-unquote revolution in how people vote. And it said that there was a cabal of corporate leaders, political operatives, and others who had done what it needed to be done in terms of suppressing stories, elevating stories, censorship, controlling what's shared on social media, and changing election laws to effect a win. And it was just, you know, I'm thinking, I'm trying to write this book, and here it's all confessed to here in Time magazine. One of the most important and interesting parts of that article was that it said that they decided that it wouldn't be good for their leftist protesters to riot on January 6th, so they called them off. And I just found that fascinating that they had that kind of control at such high levels of the Democratic Party to control their rioters. And so, absolutely, you know, you can read more about it in Time. I also tell the version, which is, you know, they're largely the same about how this was done, but it's definitely a coordinated operation, and it's a coordinated operation of the establishment. The establishment found the Trump presidency to be horrifying in its disruption to the system, and that's true mostly in the Democratic Party, but it was also true in the Republican Party, which had grown quite comfortable with the way things were being operated. And so I imagine we will continue to have some of these issues going forward, but more than anything, it's important that losers to election trust election results. That's true whether it's Republicans losing or Democrats losing, and you need to operate a system in such a way that people can have confidence in the integrity of the election. And the way that we have made some of these changes, whether or not by following the law or just by watering things down, is not healthy for the future of the country. And people of all parties, whether they're on the winning side or losing side, should care deeply about this going forward.
Let me ask one final question about going forward and the future. If these three entities have seized our elections, how do we get them to loosen their grasp, or just how do we seize back? What is the answer if you happen to have one?
As for election laws, they absolutely, people need to, and they are, this is good, paying attention to them. It needs to be banned that billionaire oligarchs can control election administration, and states are already starting to ban that. But also people need to think deeply about the privilege and the right to vote and the privilege of mail-in voting and how to balance that in a way that people can trust the system, trust the outcome. And there's a lot of work that can be done, but it's doable work. Like, this is not the end of the world. If you care about this stuff, you can change the laws and you can change the processes, and it's good for the entire country if we do that.
Molly Hemingway, Senior Journalism Fellow at Hillsdale College, Senior Editor at The Federalist, Fox News Contributor. Find her on Twitter at MZ Hemingway, and find the book everywhere, Rigged, How the Media, Big Tech, and Democrats Seized Our Elections. Molly, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
Up next, Dwight Lindley from Hillsdale's English Department returns for another segment on Victorian poetry, this time on Thomas Hardy. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Are you new to crypto? It can leave you feeling unsure of what to do. Help is available. From getting started to securing your cryptos, you don't need to go it alone. Bitcoin 530 will take you by the hand to help you move forward with your crypto journey. Schedule a free consultation with Bitcoin 530 at bitcoin530.io or give them a call at 530-324-5175. That's bitcoin530.io.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300, a reputation for excellence since 1965.
Have you been putting off getting your colonoscopy due to COVID restrictions? Well, there's no better time than now. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, colorectal cancer screenings have declined by 86%, and as a result, up to 10,000 more deaths are projected over the next decade. With early detection, colon cancer has a 90% survival rate, and it may even be preventable with a colonoscopy. At Reading Endoscopy Center, our number one priority is the health and safety of our patients, and our center has always been committed to maintaining strict infection control and prevention protocols. Schedule your colonoscopy today by calling us at 530-246-7000 or visiting readingendoscopy.com. Visit readingendoscopy.com.
Where do you go in Shasta County to get advice on the best type of firearm to meet your needs and how to safely carry and use it? The answer is to join the revolution at locally owned Bastiani Arms. Bastiani Arms believes in a better way to serve their customers and providing them with all the information needed to make the right decisions before and after the sale. They have a large selection of guns and ammunition and always special discounts for veterans. Self-protection is your right. Join the revolution at Bastiani Arms, 2539 Larkspur Lane in Reading, 222-8222.
North State Now is a magazine formatted show at 6 p.m. every Thursday night. The first Thursday is yours truly, Linda Bott, featuring what's going on in our town. The second Thursday is hosted by Michelle Slade, featuring heroes of the North State. The third Thursday is hosted by none other than James Masada and Rhonda Albee from Enjoy the Magazine and Enjoy the Store. Our newest edition is the fourth Thursday of the month, Women of Vision. That's North State Now, Thursday at 6 p.m. Also streaming on KCNR1460.com.
Aloha, this is Kevin, Operations Manager at Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. A professionally cleaned business sends a message to your paying customers. It says you are a company that cares about your image and always presenting the very best impression. Time after time, I've talked to clients who shopped for the lowest price and after a few months realized that their professional image was suffering. They didn't know who was actually coming into their offices to do the cleaning, and they just weren't getting the value they were paying for. Be wary of big-name companies that take your money, then hire unknown contractors to do the work. Since 1987, Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, your local professionals, have been offering the best in office cleaning by our screened, bonded, and insured staff. Take pride in your business and say aloha to your customers with the professional cleaning services from Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. Call 221-5868, 221-5868, MauiBob'sOfficeCleaning.com.
A Moment in History by KCNR and historian Dottie Smith. The Diesel Horse Bridge is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. It was first called the Reed's Ferry Bridge because Edward Reed, a Wintu, owned and operated his ferry at the site. Reed purchased his ferry in 1860 and operated it until 1915 when it was put out of business by the newly completed bridge. The bridge is named for the Gottlieb Diesel Horse family who owned the land and helped build the bridge. It has been the distinction of being the first reinforced concrete bridge and the first automobile bridge to cross the Sacramento River in Northern California. When it was completed in 1915, the bridge linked the county seats of Redding and Yreka and fulfilled a 1909 state bond directive. It was closed to automobile traffic in November of 1997 upon completion of the adjacent Lake Redding Bridge on the downstream side. Want more Dottie Smith? Go to the Shasta County Historical Society.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of the program. Go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. You'll also find older episodes of the show there. We're joined by Dr. Dwight Lindley, Associate Professor of English at Hillsdale College. Dr. Lindley, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me again, Scott.
Continuing our occasional series on Victorian poetry with Dr. Lindley, and today we discuss Thomas Hardy. Why are we still talking about Thomas Hardy today?
Well, that's a good question. I think he's really, frankly, better known for his novels nowadays than for his poetry. People still read his novels, such as Tess of the D'Urbervilles, Far from the Madding Crowd. They're still, you know, made into movies. There have been some excellent ones recently through the BBC and other outlets. So I think he's known for that. He himself stopped writing novels as soon as he could. As soon as he was made well off by them, he actually stopped because he would rather he really wanted to write poetry,
mm-hmm.
which is something I think we couldn't really. It would be hard for us even to understand today because, as we said in a past show, poetry is not as much part of our culture, whereas novels still are to some extent. As far as things we should know about Hardy, though, going forward, I mentioned in the past Matthew Arnold's loss of faith. Well, that was the same. It was the same situation with Thomas Hardy. Like Arnold and many others in that period, as he studied, he wasn't a university man. He was from a poorer family. He couldn't afford to go. As he educated himself, quite frankly, he came to the same conclusion that Arnold did, that he couldn't rationally continue to accept these articles of faith
mm-hmm.
that he was raised with. He was raised with a kind of evangelical Anglican religion, a very simple faith. Well, he also, like Arnold, really felt the lack of this his entire life, and it marks so many of his poems, this desire for a transcendent meaning and purpose in life, and an explainer, like something that gives meaning to the suffering of life and makes it worthwhile, which, I think we can all be very, very sympathetic to today. Still a phenomenon today. So that marks his poetry. As for some of his themes, I'll just stay on that point for a moment. The philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche in the 19th century called the death of God, right, by which he meant the passing of religion and of the value of revelation to culture and to individuals. This really marked Hardy's poems.
Dr. Lindley, what might we consider to be the most famous poem from Thomas Hardy?
His most famous poem is still today a poem about this. It's called The Darkling Thrush. And this was published 1901, and it's dated December 31st, 1900.
Hmm.
So it's the passing of the century, right at the end of Victoria's life, the end of the 19th century. And he's sort of associating with the past century also the religion of the past, of his past, of the kind of cultural past, right? You can feel in his poetry not just himself, but Victorian England moving into a new kind of more secular
mm-hmm.
Culture and way of life. In this poem, The Darkling Thrush, you've got Thomas Hardy standing out at night in the winter, and it's cold, and everything is kind of hopeless. And he says, everything seems dead and meaningless, and this is kind of how he feels at the end of his having lost his faith in everything. But then, at once, a voice arose among the bleak twigs overhead, in a full-hearted evensong of joy illimited. Evensong in the Anglican tradition is this, evening prayer service that's sung. So there's already a kind of religious sense to this bird's song. An aged thrush, frail, gaunt, and small, in blast-beruffled plume, had chosen thus to fling his soul upon the growing gloom. So Thomas Hardy hears this bird, and he's wondering, what is this bird singing about? What is there? What could he possibly, on a night like this, soul-destroying weather and all this? And then finally, so little cause for carolings of such ecstatic sound was written on terrestrial things afar or nigh around, that I could think there trembled through his happy goodnight air some blessed hope whereof he knew and I was unaware. And hope there is capitalized. He hears the apparent happiness of this bird's song, who knows to what extent birds are happy or not, but that's what he associates with it. And it demarcates this hope that he perceives elsewhere, but not in himself, and he feels the lack of it. And this really marks, it's parallel to, Hardy looks at other people who have kept their faith or still have a kind of transcendent divine charge and meaning to life, which he has lost. And he looks at them jealously. Like, why has this been denied me?
Do we have to speak a bit about his first marriage? I know that is very influential onto some of his later works.
That's very appropriate, in fact, yes. His first wife died, let's see, I don't remember the exact dates, but he was married to his first wife for the last few decades of the 19th century. She died, I think, 1902, very early in the 20th century. And they had a troubled marriage for the last, frankly, 10, 20 years of their marriage. They didn't get along very well. They were childless, wanted to have children, and that was always a burden on both of them. Well, when she died, a strange and paradoxical thing happened. He realized all of the things that she had wanted him to be to her that he wasn't. And she realized all the things that he had wanted of her that she wasn't. And he actually grew closer to her after she died in memory than before she died. It's just like this kind of thing seems paradoxical, still possible.
Hmm.
So the theme of memory is one of the things that charges his poems most and fills them with this kind of haunting sense of the past. There are ghosts, so to speak, in many of his poems, and they're the ghosts of people from his past who have remained with him, haunt him with what could have been, what wasn't, and fill him with a desire for the fulfillment that he didn't have. And so memory charges so many of his poems. Let me just read a couple lines and then we can finish up. There's a poem he wrote called The Voice. And in this poem, he's hearing the voice of his dead wife. He says, "Woman much missed, how you call to me, saying that now you are not as you were, when you had changed from the one who was all to me, but as at first, when our day was fair." And then he goes on and speaks to her as he hears her voice calling to him, echoing through time, right? and he was a very contemplative man, and he had a way of poring over the past and finding beauty in it, actually, and lovingly passing through these things which he didn't even appreciate as much at the time, and unpacking their worth, and really doing his due diligence to, like doing better by his wife, even though it was after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think there's actually something winning about that, and something true. So there's a kind of desire and languor about many of his poems.
Dr. Dwight Lindley, Associate Professor of English at Hillsdale College, talking Thomas Hardy in our occasional series here on Victorian poetry. Dr. Lindley, thanks for joining us.
Thanks again for having me, Scott. It's been a pleasure.
Up next, Joy Pullman, Executive Editor at The Federalist, also a Hillsdale graduate. We'll talk about the growth in homeschooling over these past couple of years. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hi, this is Mark from Haven Humane Society. It has been a challenging couple of years, and through it all, our amazing team has continued to save lives. We have so many fantastic animals that are looking for their forever homes, and with adoption fees so low, now is the time to add to your family. With puppies, kittens, dogs, cats, and so many more, we have the perfect addition. Come join our team as a volunteer and help in an area that works for you. Walking dogs, socializing cats, helping in our veterinary hospital, or folding laundry. We have many opportunities and welcome all volunteers. For more information, please visit our website at havenhumane.org or follow us on Facebook. On behalf of the entire Haven team, thank you for all of your continued support as together we get closer every day to North State with no more homeless pets.
Pro Rehab Physical Therapy and Sports Performance is now open at 3673 Eureka Way. Physical therapists Kevin Elo and Rachel Lang have a combined 29 years of experience in helping those who've suffered orthopedic injuries, strains, and sprains. Kevin has worked with a USA Gymnastics team, NFL Combine, and professional BMX riders. He's also helped members of Cirque du Soleil get back into action. Rachel works closely with seniors and is also a group fitness instructor and adept at returning people to an active lifestyle. Both Kevin and Rachel at Pro Rehab Physical Therapy and Sports Performance are accepting new clients. Give them a call today, 530-533-5030. If you are in need of physical therapy, talk to the experts at Pro Rehab Physical Therapy and Sports Performance at 3673 Eureka Way. Call 530-533-5030. That's 530-533-5030 today.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to www.gipath.com for more information.
Hi, this is Matt with Liberty Unabashed. It's time to embrace American values. Our society is based on the freedom, not begging the government for permission. It's time to wake up, my brothers and sisters. Come check out my show every other Sunday, 8 to 9, Liberty Unabashed.
Remodeled kitchen, bathroom, or backyard patio? There's a lot of choices, but only one leader, Estate Granite.
Mike Huber has such a professional attitude and a can-do work ethic that makes him a joy to work with. Mike and his crew worked to have our new kitchen finished in 5 days. We came back to a true work of art.
Hi, this is Brian Salato, broker and co-owner of The Real Estate Group. In today's competitive market, I think what's important is that the house is dialed in and turnkey. And what's important is that the kitchen has been renovated, the bathrooms have been renovated, granite, beautiful cabinetry. Those things make a significant difference.
Mike at Estate Granite has an eye for detail, an attention to perfection, and a quality build crew that are masters of their craft. Mike was there from start to finish.
Hi, this is Mike from Estate Granite. I know how important quality to a homeowner is, so give me a call at 241-STONE or come by our showroom at 4900 Mountain Lakes Boulevard or visit us at estategranite.com.
Hi, this is Nick. I host Poke the Hornet's Nest. 1 week from this Sunday, I'll be on at 8 a.m. Hear what's going on in Reading.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. For more information about Hillsdale College for prospective students, for alumni, or friends of Hillsdale, head to hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Joy Pullman. She is executive editor at The Federalist. Find them at thefederalist.com. She is a 2009 graduate of Hillsdale College and has written much on the topic of education and homeschooling. She is the mother of six children as well. Joy, thanks so much for joining us.
Hello. Thanks, Scott.
I want to reach back a bit. A couple of months ago, you wrote a piece at The Federalist. Homeschooling skyrocketed in 2020 as much as 700% in some states. What do the numbers say about what we knew in 2020 on homeschooling, and do we have any updates thus far as to what it looks like in 2021?
So before the lockdown really affected and disrupted, you know, the normal pattern of how, you know, Americans run schooling, the kind of numbers you would see about how many people are homeschoolers would be running from the 3 to 5% range. You know, so that's one out of every, you know, 20, 30 people in America, families with school-age kids choosing that education method. And then, you know, the article we're talking about shows that for the previous school year, so 2021-22, or sorry, that's 2020-2021, the school year just recently completed, that number went up to nationally about 1 in 5, almost 20% of American families with kids. So, you know, that is, you know, across the country, 400 or 500% increase nationwide. And as you mentioned, you know, in some places it went from almost nobody homeschooling, states like Massachusetts, to, 1% to 13%. So, you know, that's an enormous increase in anything. And you know, so I'm also looking at, there's been a few studies and there's some data being collected for this current school year, 21 to 22. And it's showing, you know, continued increases, not only rising, holding steady at that high number of about 20%, but even increasing again.
Speaking of Zoom school, Joy, how much, and I don't know if there's a hard number you can place on this, of course, but how much of this change, of this increase in homeschooling, might be due to the fact many parents, for the very first time, were able to hear and see what their kids were being taught in these schools?
Oh, I think that is a significant part of it, but I also think that the lockdown kind of chaos and disruptions and parents disagreeing both ways over COVID policy, so some wanting, you know, much more, you know, concerned and alarmed sort of measures in schools versus parents wanting their kids to be freely back in school and educating and focused completely on learning instead of, you know, how their mask fits their face. You know, so both ways, you know, so I think one of my colleagues, Spencer Lindquist, interviewed a number of, you know, people and running homeschool organizations across the country who were dealing, you know, with all these new families and talking to them. And so they basically said the curriculum concerns and the lockdown concerns on both sides were really, you know, the major things that they were hearing from parents. And another significant aspect of this is Black American families went from 3% of them homeschooling pre-lockdown to, you know, 13-15% of them homeschooling currently. And we know, you know, from other polling data that, you know, Black Americans are much more likely to be concerned about COVID's threat, you know, to their health. And so, you know, I would expect, especially among that group, that, you know, wanting a safer environment or what's perceived as a safer environment for their kids is also driving that.
Joy, do you think that the increase is relatively sustainable? And perhaps we can look to the past. Do parents who homeschool tend to remain parents who homeschool?
So I'm a homeschool graduate myself. So, you know, I grew up not only being homeschooled, but, you know, I've spoken at state homeschooling conferences and regional ones. I've been to a lot of conventions. I still continue to go. So there's kind of a couple of different groups of people who homeschool. So there are some who are really and heavily invested in it. So they either really just love the way that it allows the flexibility for their family. You know, so these are people, maybe the dad has a flexible job. They do a lot of travel, or, you know, they just really, you know, love the kind of extreme customization of lifestyle that you can do when you're homeschooling. Or, you know, there's people who are concerned and interested with what their children are specifically learning, and they believe that they can provide, you know, much better education experience than most of or all of their other options locally. You know, so there's that one category of very committed people that I mean, I don't know what percentage of them is right now in the homeschooling pool, but I know they exist. But then there's also a lot of people who homeschool for a couple of years for what I would call practical reasons. So, I mean, so there are kind of two groups there. And with all of this huge churn going on with all these new and, you know, I would consider a lot of these families not ideologically committed, right? They're doing
sure.
for tactical, practical reasons right now. So I don't know, you know, what their choices are going to be in the years ahead. I think some will, you know, stick with the homeschooling because they, you know, thought before it was too intimidating, you know, but then they discover they love it. But I also think a lot of people will, you know, go back to the more conventional schooling methods.
Joy Pullman with us, a 2009 graduate of Hillsdale College, executive editor at The Federalist. You can find this piece at thefederalist.com from a couple of months ago on homeschooling data. Homeschooling is parents are finding it to be a good alternative. Is there a worry, Joy, with the increase in these numbers that, of course, that will perhaps prompt the government to impose additional regulations on those who wish to homeschool their children?
That could be the case. I mean, there's calls for the government to regulate everything under the sun right now, you know, including whether we can even breathe. So, that's probably to be expected. But at the same time, you know, if you've moved your constituency of people who might oppose that from 3-5%, and those 3-5% have been extremely effective over the years in creating freedom for themselves, you know, to oversee their kids' education with, you know, limited interference from government bureaucrats. You know, so if 3-5% have been so effective so far, I would expect 15-20% to be only, you know, monumentally more effective in securing things for themselves. I also think that dramatic increase creates a potential watershed moment for shifting state education dollars and systems away from funding institutions to funding students, because you'll have parents, again, who are not the ideologically committed very small minority of homeschoolers who, you know, would reject government funds, you know, out of the concerns that, very valid concerns that with it would come strings, such as requirements to teach kids all the stuff they're trying to keep them away from, critical race theory and so forth in school. But you'll have a lot of parents who basically say, why am I paying taxes for my, you know, and not getting any benefit of that, or, you know, having the system I pay taxes for attack me, tell me I'm stupid, and I can't teach my own children, so on and so forth. So again, you know, a lot of potential ferment there, but I only see this detachment of parents from institutional public schooling. It's probably likely to continue as the effects of lockdowns make public schools even more inhospitable environments for children in the years ahead.
Final question for Joy Pullman, executive editor of The Federalist, 2009 graduate of Hillsdale College. As parents are beginning to homeschool, continue to homeschool, or perhaps those who are still making up their mind, they're going to need resources. They're going to need assistance. We, of course, have some here at Hillsdale, k12.hillsdale.edu. There's information there. What kind of advice, what kind of resources might you recommend to parents who are either beginning this journey or still considering it?
Sometimes people don't have a very good school available to them. And, you know, homeschooling is often their very best option. So I think you basically need to do sort of, you know, examine your personal situation. You know, are you a family who has, you know, one or two children, you know, versus do you have 4 to 6 children? You know, that changes your opportunities and what you're able to get done in a day. Also, you know, are you a family where the parents are well-educated and really good at, you know, self-management and focus and, you know, getting the household through tasks, versus do you have children who maybe should spend some time working on character qualities such as, you know, not procrastinating, such as attention to detail and so forth, you know, that really need to kind of be shifted into place before you can efficiently accomplish an education. So, I mean, I don't mean to, you know, be flip here, but I think what is best for every family really depends on circumstances for a family like that, even before you get to the curriculum. I would recommend then going, you know, to your local homeschool groups and talking through with the other parents what works for them and listening very carefully to why it works for them and the strengths of a particular approach, and then try to match that very carefully to your own circumstances.
Joy Pullman, executive editor at The Federalist. You can find this piece over at thefederalist.com. Homeschooling skyrocketed in 2020, as much as 700% in some states. She's also a 2009 graduate of Hillsdale College. Joy, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks for having me.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Molly Hemingway, her new book, Rigged, How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections. We talked with Dwight Lindley from Hillsdale's English Department about Thomas Hardy and Victorian poetry. And finally, Joy Pullman from The Federalist on the rise in homeschooling. You can hear new episodes every week on the station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews, including Molly Hemingway, anytime on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Email the show at radiohour@hillsdale.edu. The assistant producer of the program is Nate Esbenshade. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
At Shasta Regional Medical Group, we're focused on the health matters that matter to you, like having a primary care doctor you trust. Our physicians put patients first. They take the time to listen to your needs and concerns, and they provide the information you need to make good decisions about your own health. At Shasta Regional Medical Group, you have an integrated network of caregivers and specialists working to serve you in a compassionate, patient-centered environment. We're conveniently located right across the street from Shasta Regional Medical Center. To make an appointment, call Shasta Regional Medical Group today at 605-4260 or visit us online at ShastaRegionalMedicalGroup.com. Shasta Regional Medical Group. Your primary care is our primary concern.
Good morning, Reading. This is Rick Hughes, host of The Flatline. Heard every Sunday morning on KCNR 96.5 FM at 7 a.m. in the morning. Just want you to know that God has given us two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. And success in life depends on which one you use. It's heads you win and tails you lose. Come join me on The Flatline and learn about God's tremendous problem-solving device. 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, 96.5 FM, KCNR.
It's a bright new day. The sun is shining, the birds are singing, and there's never been a better day to try Mount Shasta spring water. Hi, I'm Bob the Drop. I come from a protected spring at the base of Mount Shasta. I'm bottled at the source. It doesn't get more cool and refreshing than that, and it's delivered right to your door. Yep, pure and simple, naturally the best. Start your bright new day by calling 1-800-922-6227 to order some of the best tasting water on the planet, Mount Shasta spring water.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Common Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good, healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide three delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wayne Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
This is Carl Bott. Join Linda and me Wednesday as we welcome Captain Brian Cole of the Reading Police Department with stats on last year's crime and proposals for what they're going to do this year in law enforcement. Also joining us is Kathy Darling Allen, County Registrar, with information on the February 1st special election. All this, KCNR, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio. Miss a day, miss a lot.
Hi, this is Chuck Kenny with Shasta Gas Propane. It's been a while since I've cut a new radio spot, but I feel I need to issue a warning about energy prices during this fall-winter of 2021 and 22. Just as Obama said after he was elected, elections have consequences. This winter, our country will suffer some of the consequences of the last election. I'm not a politician, but I am a businessman, and many of the decisions of this current administration will drastically affect energy prices this winter and going forward. Already we are experiencing record high propane costs and prices. Remember, our motto at Shasta Gas Propane is, our customers are warm friends. We will treat you like friends this winter and do our best to help you through this high price winter. Give us a call at 365-3793. That's 365-3793.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.
You know, it can be difficult to find a trustworthy, knowledgeable, and yet affordable auto repair shop. Advanced Automotive is a second-generation, locally owned, full-service repair shop serving our community since 1993, and one of only four AAA-approved auto repair shops in the Reading area. Advanced Automotive has a goal, and it's to keep it simple to have safe, reliable vehicles for our customers and our community. Call or come by to meet the crew who is here to serve you. 244-4423. Advanced Automotive.
Art isn't your pet, it's your kid. It grows up and talks back to you. Joss Whedon.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, Your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.